Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. It's great to welcome back into the studio for a regular or semi-regular commentary on what's going on around the world, Susan Carlin. Susan, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you so much.
Susan, this week, I mean, we talk about the sort of importance of getting mutual understanding on multicultural issues. Well, Senator Cory Bernardi has plunged back into the fray, calling for an inquiry into halal food.
I know. Who didn't see this coming? Cory Bernardi certainly has things that he likes to focus on. The burqa is one, and halal food now. So, yes, he has. It has been passed. The inquiry has been passed by the Senate. So it will happen. And, you know, Senator Bernardi has in the past expressed concern about where halal money, quote, ends up, unquote. You know, a sort of a nod to the common, well, hopefully not too common, fear that somehow halal certification funds terrorism, despite the fact that, you know, ABC Fact Check has shown that that's not true. The Australian Crime Commission has said, nope, no evidence for that. It still persists. So Cory Bernardi has, he's putting in a parliamentary inquiry into what he calls the racket. Now, he's been careful to also include kosher food under this, organic food. He wants to check out any and all food certification and labelling laws here in Australia, and that's what he set out to do. But he does seem to have a particular interest in halal certification.
Just remind us what halal certification is all about.
So halal certification, all it means in theory is that this is, it'll be something that has a stamp on it that says this is absolutely okay for Muslims to eat. In the same way, you know, that you might get kosher certification. Now, halal is not nearly as strict as kosher. It's much easier for something to be halal. Basically, it shouldn't have any pork in it or alcohol or any meat products that may not be halal. So, for example, yogurt that has gelatine in it, so long as the gelatine in it comes from cows that were slaughtered in a halal way, then that's halal. So it's, you know, things like water don't need to be halal certified, or fruits and vegetables. You know, none of those things need to be halal certified. They are in and of themselves halal. But some products like to have halal certification in Australia, especially if they're going to be exported to Muslim majority countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, you know, some of our closest neighbours, because the halal industry is already $1 trillion a year industry. It's massive. So halal certification doesn't change anything. You know, your Vegemite doesn't suddenly taste different because it's halal certified. All it is a little stamp on it that shows that people who know about these things have gone to check and said, yeah, there is no alcohol in here. There is no animal product in here. Everything is completely okay for Muslims to have. So go for it.
Yeah, and to be fair, at this side, there are costs and benefits associated with this. That is, for industry, it actually is important for our export trade that we do have some means of authenticating halal for Muslim communities. There's an important role for having authentication of halal, if you wish to be true to your faith. And on the other side, people are saying, oh no, this is a cost on all consumers and we shouldn't have to bear it.
Well, the two things on that. First of all, that's why Barnaby Joyce is so upset about this, because if there is the fear that if we come down too hard on the halal certification market and make it impossible for things to be officially halal certified, then our beef can no longer be exported to massive industries like in Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Middle East in general. So it does have a big knock-on effect. The other issue, and I think this is something that Cory seems to be wanting to find out, which, you know, in and of itself isn't problematic, is how much does it cost to get this certification? So it's the cost benefit, as you said, that the certification itself often doesn't cost a lot. It costs maybe $1,000 to get. But that $1,000, for example, then means that, you know, your cookies can now confidently be sold in Indonesia for many, many, many tens of thousands of dollars because the Indonesian market will be like, oh, good, it's halal. We don't have to worry about it. We know we can buy it. The other thing to keep in mind is this is a choice. No one has to be halal certified if they don't want to be. This isn't being enforced on any business who doesn't want to take it. And some choose not to. And that's their prerogative and good for them. But for those businesses that do and do want, especially the export market, incredibly important.
Now, on the populist fear side of the equation, you seem to have two fears being advanced. One is it changes our food and why should we do it? And the other one is this is money, that is the money being charged by those groups who do certify the food, is leaking off and leeching off into terrorist organisations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, the Australian Crimes Commission has said there is no evidence at all that halal funding goes to halal certification goes to fund terrorism. ABC Fact Check did a story on this and said, again, no evidence whatsoever that this is happening. So, you know, we need to be careful that we don't let facts get in the way of our bigotry. But really, I mean, in all seriousness, I think it is, you know, just because people fear things doesn't mean that it's true. And when all facts suggest that it's not true, then we need to really think about, well, how much do we entertain this? You know, eating halal food doesn't suddenly make you Muslim. You know, it's simply like the organic stamp or like the kosher stamp or the gluten-free stamp. It's simply a statement about what is or isn't in the food for the people that it matters to. And that's it. Like I said, it doesn't change anything. No wine company is going to go and be halal certified and then suddenly not have alcohol in them. They're not going to do it. So it's for things where it makes no difference anyway.
I've heard stories about wine. I have.
Get alcohol-free wine. Maybe there's that. But generally, I don't think Foster's will be lining up to be halal certified anytime soon.
Okay, let's move on. Well, before we leave it, one of the good things, surely, about having an inquiry is that you can put to bed once and for all a lot of this tosh.
Well, you would really hope so. Like, if anything, I do hope that it may allay people's fears, because it does make me sad that people genuinely seem to have this terror that, whoa, what's going on and what does it mean? And, you know, if this inquiry could lay to bed any concerns they have, that would be a nice thing.
And we do have examples from other places in the world of where, in fact, the reverse applies. That is, groups trying to take advantage of halal certification.
Well, and wasn't that a disaster? There's a recent example in the United Kingdom where they found that supermarket chain Aldi inadvertently halal certified black pudding with pig blood. Now, this could not be much more non-halal if it tried, because not only does it have pork in it, but Muslims also can't eat any blood at all, even chicken blood or lamb blood. So this was as non-halal as it, short of drowning it in vodka, this is as unhalal as it could get. And yet, it somehow, there was a mix-up somewhere, they got a stamp on it, and who knows for how long Muslims were eating.
We need an inquiry.
Yeah, well, that's something maybe Corey Bernardi can look into that after this one's finished.
Good. Now, there is a wider story going on this week that, again, is part of the background noise in Australian politics, moves to the foreground more often than we wanted to, and that's continuing refugee crisis. Rohingya Muslims have been fleeing Myanmar, Burma, because of persecution there in some parts of the state that hasn't yet been resolved. Their boats have been coming down past Thailand into Malaysia, into Indonesia. There's a standoff. Boats have been 3-4 weeks stuck out at sea. This week, both Indonesia and Malaysia have said they will accept those boatloads of Rohingyas coming from Burma, Myanmar, but Australia should also do its bit. This has not gone down well with the Australian government. The Australians have said, no, sorry.
Yeah. In fact, in the words of Tony Abbott, nope, nope, nope was his response. He really wasn't entertaining this at all. And he just said, you know, I'm sorry, but you come through the front door if you want to come into our country, not the back door, was what he said, which is, I mean, that's pretty full-on language to use to people who, as you said, I mean, 8,000 they estimate have been stranded offshore in boats for weeks. We know for a fact that a number of them died. We know at least 7 children died of starvation and dehydration on these boats while they were just being ping-ponged backwards and forwards from country to country. It's a pretty grim situation for them. Indonesia and Malaysia finally said, okay, we will take them temporarily. We'll take them for a year. But then we need the international community to help us house them, because we simply don't have room. And as you said, Tony Abbott quickly squashed any hope that any of them would be coming here, and said absolutely not.
Could invite a cheap comparison between Muslim compassion and Christian compassion, couldn't it?
Well, I would not want to make that comparison, but, you know, by all means.
Well, if we're playing populist politics, you know, why not throw that one in?
Yeah, well, it is. It's a really, and it's such an unfortunate religious mess, this one. You know, Myanmar is a Buddhist majority country, and it's really awful to see what's happening, unfortunately, between the Buddhists in Myanmar and the Muslim Rohingya. The Rohingya are essentially stateless people in the country that they have lived in for many generations. nations. In 1982, the Myanmar government revoked all of their citizenship of the hundreds of thousands, millions even, of Rohingya Muslims who live there. Now they're effectively stateless. They can have their property taken off them arbitrarily. They even have, which could actually be the world's first instance of child limiting how many children you can have based on religion, where the Muslim Rohingyas have a two-child limit, whereas their Buddhist neighbours do not. So things are pretty bad there. The United Nations have said they are probably one of the most persecuted refugee groups in the world. There was really bad mob violence against them in 2012, which is a reason why a lot of them are trying to leave. And it's so messy, you know, when we heard Tony Abbott say, well, you know, just turn, we do not accept them, turn them back, send them back to where they came from. In the state of the Rohingya, that's incredibly problematic because they are a stateless people.
Yes, there's nowhere
to go.
They
literally
have
nowhere to go. Myanmar does not acknowledge them as citizens, so they have nowhere to go, which is why they were just trapped out at sea. And as we saw, starving to death.
And this actually shows the way in which once you open these doors to this sort of feeling, this sort of ethos that we control who comes into our borders, you actually begin to move from the number of legitimate or illegitimate refugees, or if they are refugees or not, coming to a situation where even those who can demonstrate most clearly that they fit the classic definition of a refugee, a stateless, persecuted person who faces death if they have to go back to where they come from, are now being denied. I mean, how do we get to this over 6 or 7 years?
Well, that's the thing. It's when the journey takes precedence over the nature of the claim. And what's, I think, especially worrying to me, and it was so starkly illustrated in the case of the Rohingya, is Tony Abbott has always said, the boats are dangerous, people die on boats, that's why we have to turn them back in the interest of people not dying at sea. Now, what we saw in the case of the Rohingya, with the boats being turned back and having nowhere to go, is that caused people to die at sea. The fact that they were turned back and were trapped out there and people died. But some of the people who were on the boat said up to 200 people died of starvation or fighting because they were fighting over food scraps and their bodies just thrown overboard. We don't know if we'll ever know how many people died out there, but we know for a fact that people died because the boats were turned back. And that really starts to deeply illustrate the inherent problems with this argument.
And one is not sure that the government of Myanmar would be too sympathetic to an idea of persecuting the people smugglers taking those Rohingya out of Myanmar.
Well, absolutely. The 15 countries in the Southeast Asia region have called a meeting for the 29th of May to discuss this very problem. The Myanmar government has said they will not even attend the meeting if the word Rohingya is used. This is the attitude toward the people living in their country and the people that are fleeing. So when we have that attitude towards them, it's going to be a very difficult conversation to try to change what are essentially those push factors.
This is an issue that's not going to go away in a hurry.
No, it's not.
Let's talk to some Australians who may wish to return to this country and their journey back may also be problematic. That is, young Australians who are caught up with the adventure in Syria for some, challenge in Syria to others, allegedly
nightmare in Syria
with
for
ISIS.
Many.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it's so this week what's come to light is that there are, we think, at least three Australians who have somehow been caught up in what's happening in Syria. At least one of them denies having any involvement with ISIS per se. He says he was just a nurse there working and got sort of caught up inadvertently in the machinations, but didn't himself support the system. They've been there for a while and they say they want to come back. Now, Tony Abbott, as adamantly as he said nope, nope, nope to the Rohingya people, has said it's a crime, it's a crime, it's a crime. He seems to like saying things in threes. And what he's saying is there is no way we'll ever allow you back. Your passports have been revoked. Don't even think about it. Now, on face value, it's understandable. We could see why would we ever want these people back in our country? First, I mean, you can certainly make the first argument they haven't, nothing's been proven against them, you know, especially this nurse who said, I never fought with ISIS. But even if we leave that to the side, what's interesting is that we're seeing that counter-terrorism experts in Australia are saying these people could actually be our best defence against ISIS. If we can somehow bring them back, they, you know, face due process as they should and, you know, if necessary, be jailed for their crimes. But these could be some of the best defence we have against ISIS because they may be disillusioned fighters. If nothing else, they've certainly seen firsthand what ISIS are doing. And they will be able to come back and perhaps de-radicalise or mentor young people who are thinking of going to join ISIS and tell them, no, I've seen firsthand what's happening. This isn't what you think. Don't believe the hype, I can tell you. So there is the argument that they could actually be one of our best weapons against further radicalisation of young people here. Now, of course, the issue is, as people have raised it, I think it's a fair question. Can we trust them? You know, they say they want to come back. They say they've changed their mind. They don't want to be involved in ISIS or whatever. But can we trust them with that? Do they really mean that? If they come back, could they be a security threat? And that's the conversation that's happening now.
Yes, and of course, we've developed all sorts of sophisticated means for dealing with people who may have antisocial tendencies and criminal tendencies, from ankle bracelets to all sorts of other things. So that is probably not beyond our wit to deal with.
Well, yeah, and if it could be something that would effectively counteract the narrative that ISIS are using, I mean, that could be quite a good tools to have in our tool belt.
There's something else here too. We've seen news bulletins featuring in the last day or so the situation facing the ancient city of Palmyra and the fact that groups like ISIS have, when they've come across such sacred archaeological sites in the past, have basically trashed them. And there's two elements to the trashing. One is that they wanted to face and get rid of any religious ideology which has preceded them, so sacred images get destroyed or mosques or temples. But also there is the looting for the purpose of getting hold of the artefacts to sell them on the market and fund what ISIS are doing. The interesting part about this is people are singling out ISIS, as they should, as trashing one of the great treasures of civilization, or potentially trashing it. Yet this is not something that's peculiar to ISIS. It's almost peculiar to any group which has a strong sense of its own purity of mission. It could apply to the Christians during Cromwell's era in England, the Puritans defacing churches, but it could all equally apply to civil society, to Stalin and his attitude about purging those who didn't agree with him. This notion of purging for the sake of purity is not essentially a religious notion.
Absolutely. And just to eradicate the memory, I mean, this is not even a relatively recent phenomenon. I've travelled in Egypt and, you know, you go and look inside the pyramids or at the wall friezes. And what's so strikingly common is how often any statue or painting with a person's face has been chipped off. And that was, sorry, I'm going to cough. Hang on. Sorry, you can edit that out. That was done not recently, but generally by the pharaoh that came after the person who had those ones built, because they wanted to eradicate that person's memory from the collective consciousness. They didn't want anyone to remember them. I am the important pharaoh or godlike creature now, and everyone else is to be forgotten. So this is a very sad trait of humankind, that we seem to like to destroy any evidence of power or significance that came before us.
It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try every means we can to defeat ISIS, but we need to remember there is a wider context here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Look, let's finish on a couple of happier notes. You've got a wonderful story dug around for those who aren't sort of, for those of us who come from that wider, diverse culture of New South Wales and Queensland, there is a Muslim women's AFL team.
Well, first of all, why don't you like AFL? Secondly, yes, there is a Muslim women's footy team. It's made up predominantly of Muslim women. Many of them wear the hijab or the headscarf. And they have been asked to play a historic curtain raiser event at the MCG next month. So the Auburn Tigers is the name of the team. They used to be the Auburn Tigers. Now they're the Auburn Giants. They started about 5 years ago. And they are going to be taking to the G before Collingwood's clash with Greater Western Sydney on the 14th of June. So this is a fantastic statement about multiculturalism, but also Muslim women. It's the first time a Muslim women's team has played before an AFL crowd at the G. So this is huge for so many reasons, and just such, it's the kind of event I imagine photographers just adore, because there'll be so many fantastic images of women in hijab taking, I hope, screamers above their opponents. And it's just so visually fantastic to see.
We've got to think of an up there line, haven't we?
Exactly. The question is this halal certified? I think we need to investigate that as well.
And also an example of interfaith charity that is just a terrific one, particularly in a country that's had more than its fair share of interfaith tension right from its foundation.
Exactly. This is a really nice story, and we don't hear enough of these, so it is a good one to finish on, where Bihar, which is India, a group of Muslims in Bihar have come together and donated a huge chunk of land to help build the world's largest Hindu temple. This temple is going to be massive. It will seat 20,000 people, so it is pretty massive. And Muslims donated, you know, a number of Muslim families came together and donated the land for this big temple to be built. And it's, you know, it's a lovely thing to see, as you said, in India, where there can be, you know, and there has been a lot of religious conflict, to see something like this happening where Muslims are saying, here, have our land. This is ours. We want to give it to you. Build your Hindu temple. And it's a lovely sign. It's, you know, Muslims have helped to build Hindu temples before, but obviously nothing of this massive scale.
And in this particular political context where
absolutely,
the current government of India has a great deal of support from emerging Hindu nationalists and even Hindu fundamentalists.
So, absolutely. It's a really important sign. And good to know that they're going to make it earthquake-proof, since it will be near the Nepal border. So that's a nice addition, I think.
Yeah. And we should remember those in Nepal. And if you want to give to Nepal, please. Most aid agencies are still taking the money. Susan Carlin, been great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us once again on Sunday Night.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.